Purposes BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0, Germany's Economics Podcast with Daniel Stetter.
Hello and welcome. My name is Daniel Stetter. In March of this year, I stumbled over an article in the Financial Times. The title, Time for a Great Reset of the Financial System. Normally, I'm quite skeptical once it comes to such statements, as they seem quite extreme. On the other hand, I have discussed several times in my podcast the major problems of the world economy and the increased fragility due to the increased levels of private and public debt. They clearly require a solution. Reading such an article in the renowned Financial Times motivated me to get in touch with the author directly and discuss his thoughts. Here he is.
Chris Wedling is founder of Longview Economics, an independent financial market research house. Longview has built relationships with over 150 clients across the globe and is constantly seeking to deliver cutting-edge market analysis and trading ideas. Chris has been obsessed with markets and generating intelligent investment advice since beginning his career at Kazanov in 1994.
Dear Chris, a warm welcome to my podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to be here, Daniel. Appreciate the invite.
Chris, I thought it would be interesting to talk to you because I read a very interesting piece you wrote in the Financial Times in March, where you basically said, well, it's time for a great reset of the financial system. And I found it interesting because in the Financial Times, to read about the need for a great reset of the financial system is a strong statement. So, what leads you to a belief that there is a need for a reset of the financial system?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. It was great to get the article in the FT, and I appreciate them putting it in. I realize it's not necessarily their normal type of article. But yeah, I mean, I've been studying the monetary system of the world in conjunction with my job in financial markets, which is predicting financial market direction across global asset classes and across the globe. So as part of that, I've spent 30 years trying to work out how markets work and how the banking system and the monetary policy interact with financial markets. And I've come to the conclusion that this one we have at the moment, the international monetary system that's a fiat dollar system, is basically tired and has passed its expiry date. I mean, in that respect, you can say that, firstly, I would say I don't think there's a perfect international monetary system. I don't think there's any example of a system that's never built up tensions over the two or three decades when most of them have existed and ultimately had to be redesigned and reset. And I think this one's just the same. It's on average, international monetary systems last 20 or 30 years. This one's, since 1971, just 50 years old. So it's very old in terms of the sort of length that these systems tend to last. And I just think this one is stretched at the margins. There's the whole structure of it has allowed us to have this debt super cycle. I think David Graeber is very good on his book and the 5,000 years history of debt. And it makes it quite clear that you don't get private debt super cycles like the one we have had in the last 20 or 30 years. It's utterly unique. And I think understanding what's driving that gives you a sense of why it needs to change. And of course, the massive buildup of indebtedness, the massive expansion of commercial banking systems, balance sheets, all of this is related to the way the structure of the system's set up. And all of this has delivered a system whereby the few do very well and the majority do very poorly. Ultimately, they're highly indebted and the inequality rises. And I think the monetary system and the banking system and the way they interact with the housing markets are all at the heart of the sort of income and wealth inequality that we see today. So we have a system that really channels money and savings into unproductive uses like mortgage debt and pumping up house prices, and a system that doesn't channel money and savings into productive uses in business and investment in the economy. And that actually goes a long way to explaining the type of structure of economies we have today, highly indebted, very high consumption share of GDP, very low investment share of GDP, and very low productivity growth in many of them. So, you know, that's why I think we need a reset. I think it's old, it's tired, it's expired. I mean, you just need to look at the fact interest rates are zero or negative in many parts of the world, and we're printing money hand over fist to get a sense of it being tired and old and expired. And I think we should reset.
But if you let's before we come to the reset, let's probably get to a better understanding of how the system works. So the system is currently a system where banks create new money by handing out loans. And as you point out in your article, the most preferred assets banks finance is real estate, which explains the rise in real estate prices. And we all know, or most people know, that the increase in wealth in the Western world is mainly driven by higher real estate prices. So Thomas Piketty's worries around the inequality is basically nothing else than reflections that real estate prices have gone up because of higher leverage. That's basically what you're saying. But is this a problem around the system, or is it just that we forgot to tell banks that they should focus their lending on productive users?
Well, no, it's a problem around the system. So I have this story of a sort of a mortgage queue to an eighth, which works well in the UK and actually works pretty well in most countries. If you think back to the 1970s, you know, if you wanted in the UK, and this is the same in many parts of the world, America, Australia, parts of Europe, if you wanted to have a mortgage, you had to, in the UK, for example, get in a queue at a building society and wait until enough people had saved enough money. And the building society manager said, OK, great. You're next in line. Here's your mortgage. Off you go. Which is actually goes to the heart of the origins of building societies in a pub in Britain, I think, when 15 people stand around a table and draw straws as to who would get the first mortgage. And between the 15, they saved every month. And the first guy, you know, once there was enough savings, got his mortgage and bought his house and onto the second one. So that was not about money creation. That's the point. That's about savings being used to create a mortgage, rather than, as you said, post Thatcher deregulation and Reagan deregulation in the early 80s, and then Basel 1, 2, and 3, the regulatory systems that have been brought to bear, such that commercial banks have entered the mortgage space, and when they make a loan, they create new money. So you get to the stat that Positive Money, a London-based think tank, put out a few years ago, that in the 10 years leading up to the financial crisis, 97% of money was created by commercial banks, new money. And of all that money that was created, I think the stat is, let me make sure I get it right, 40% went into the property bubble, 37% went into financial markets and speculation, 10% of that newly created money went to credit cards and personal loans, and 13% to businesses. So really what your banking system in textbooks is supposed to do is channel savings into businesses. But actually only 13% of the expansion of their balance sheets went that way. And by the way, it was newly created money, most of it anyway. So and why is this different? This is different post-1971. And particularly post-1980, because prior to that, almost all international monetary systems had an anchor. And of course, this one is a fiat dollar system. It has no anchor. And if you don't have an anchor, you can create as much liquidity as you want globally, which is another way of saying you can create as much debt as you want across the globe. And of course, that's exactly what's happened. And that's why we've had a debt supercycle that is, really quite enormous. I mean, there are no historical precedents in private sector debt terms for what we've had in the last 20 or 30 years. And of course, really, from the Babylonians all the way through till 1971, almost all monetary systems, they all had an anchor, whether it's silver and gold, or it's copper, et cetera, until this one. This is utterly new, unique. And yes, as we all know, monetary systems, governments took monetary systems off their anchors during wars. They printed money and then they put them back on the anchor post the war. Of course, Churchill famously doing that in the 20s, causing a Great Depression in the UK. And yes, there are issues with that. As I said, no system's perfect. But the point is, basically, other than wars, for a few thousand years, as much a history as we have, there's always been an anchor until the last 20, 30, 40 years.
So, but you point out that it was a political will because, you know, Reagan and Thatcher, they wanted to mobilize the economy. That's why they did deregulation. So I think politicians were happy for increased debt levels because it generated the illusion of wealth. At the same time, central banks, in my view, also play a role because whenever something happens, whenever there was a crisis, a recession or whatever, they lowered interest rates. And the Bank for International Settlement speaks about an asymmetrical reaction. So those central banks also play an important role in this debt supercycle, do they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the debt supercycle, I think there's a triumvirate of factors that have driven it. One is the new international monetary system without an anchor that we just talked about. The second is the Basel deregulation, 1, 2, and 3, or the initial financial deregulation, then the three Basels.
The Basel Accords refers to a set of banking supervision regulations set by the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. They were developed over several years between 1980 and 2011, undergoing several modifications over the years. The Basel Accords were formed with the goal of creating an international regulatory framework for managing credit risk and market risk. Their key function is to ensure that banks hold enough cash reserves to meet their financial obligations and survive in financial and economic distress.
And particularly during Basel, the fact that risk weightings on assets on corporate debts remained at 100% throughout. And for mortgages over the course of the last 20, 30 years, the two or three round of Basel, you know, they initially went to 50% risk weighting on mortgages, then to, I think it was 35. And then you calculate your own if you're a big bank. And so many of the big banks are now down 13, 14% or so risk weightings on mortgages versus 100. So they're incentivized to do mortgages. And then the third factor is absolutely, as you say, central banks have really been, since the New Zealand central bank in the early 1990s, it's been all about inflation targeting, and they've increasingly ignored or pushed to one side monetary metrics and monetary targets, which of course is where all the money gets created and reflected and so on. So central bank inflation targeting with CPI targeting, I think, is the third factor of three that's allowed this sort of debt super cycle to play out over the last 20, 30 years.
So now we have a situation where we've got high debt levels, high private sector debt levels. We have now also in many countries high government debt levels, especially now with post-corona. Some people would say, well, it doesn't matter because debt doesn't cost anything. We can continue this way. But you seem to think that we can't continue this way, that we need to somehow get rid of the high debt levels.
Yeah, I think what we've seen over the last 20, 30 years is effectively the high debt levels and the financial crisis causing the sort of nationalistic politics and the rise of nationalism in many countries and the political division. And with that, of course, you know, the income inequality and wealth inequality. Or another way of putting it is by channeling money and savings into unproductive uses, we're undermining our productivity growth. And productivity growth is really the heart of broad-based income growth.
You mean because how does it undermine? Because we don't invest enough into productive uses in new machinery and equipment. That's the reason, or do you see another factor driving or leading to low productivity growth?
Well, we're channeling money rather than channeling money into businesses, we're channeling it into mortgage debt, and mortgage and housing is not a productive asset. It's as simple as that. But you add to that, because what happens is, of course, you then have too much indebtedness, and you have, you know, you end up with a financial banking crisis, and then you socialize the losses, as we did in the GFC. You know, you push the losses through the tax system onto the man on the street. So, you know, not only is he not benefiting from the broad based productivity growth and economy that drives broad based real income growth, but he's also suffering from austerity post-financial crisis, as he has to repay the losses brought about by the banking system and the build-up of indebtedness before that.
Okay, now we have a world with very high debt levels. What should we do? Because I would say my impression is always politicians are hoping for inflation to do the fix.
Yeah, well, I don't know about you. I feel I've been listening to that story for a long time, and they're struggling to get it to come through. And of course, if they do get it to come through, there's every chance they'll lose control of inflation. So I personally think I like the idea of a debt jubilee that, you know, and whether it's a cancellation of partial debt or all the debt or large chunks of it, I don't know. I think that's up for discussion. But there's too much debt in the world, so why not cancel it? And as I said in the FT article, you can start with the government debt that's owned by the central banks. Now, I know there's some challenges to do with accounting, and every time you create new money, and you know, there's a liability, there's another side to that. But I think these can be dealt with. I think these, with some creative accounting, you can get past these problems. So, yeah, I think reset the system, and one part of that is cancelling some or lots of debt.
So, but you know, but look, let's go step by step. So, basically, the central banks are holding big chunks of government debt, also especially in the Eurozone. And you basically say, okay, they should just cancel it. That's what Adair Turner is also saying. Just cancel the debt. So write it off, or basically say, okay, we will never ask it back, because the Japanese are on the same path. So that's one part of it. Then you say, okay, but it's only a part of it. It's not really a big, because it's just a small chunk held by the central bank. Still, the biggest part is still held by private people, by private sector. So how should it work in the private sector? Like, make this very concrete. So many Germans have a life insurance. The life insurance is normally buying government bonds. So the government now is canceling the debt. So life insurance is gone. So it's, you know, it's always easy to talk about debt cancellation, but it also means wealth cancellation in a certain sense.
Yeah, of course. But then you have to think about who holds most of the wealth. So in a sense, you know, the vast majority of wealth, and I forget the stats, but the vast majority of it's held by the few. So there is an argument that for the last 20 or 30 years, there's been wealth transfer effectively from the bottom 90% to the top 10. And if you cancel wealth, you're effectively doing a transfer the other way. When you're cancelling debt, you're reversing that movement, if you like. But yes, I understand there's lots of complications, but certainly cancelling the government debt that's held on the central bank's balance sheet, you say it's not that significant. I mean, it's not insignificant. It's not trivial. I forget what the exact number is. I think it's 25 trillion, wasn't it? Something like that. So there's quite a lot there already. you could do that. You basically merge the central bank with the treasury of the country, and essentially reverse double entry accounting. You're left with a reserves liability, and I think you can swap the reserves into a perpetual bond that has zero interest. So it just sort of dies. It just sort of sits there and dies. And then you can spin the central bank out again and work on whatever monetary system you want to bring to bear. So you can do that. I understand there are complications once you start cancelling other debt. And that's why I think you need a new Bretton Woods to discuss and negotiate. Maybe you take the G20 and there's an across-the-board haircut on all mortgage debt by 10 or 15%. Now, someone's the other side of that, so someone loses out. Absolutely. But, you know, I just think it's about redressing the balance. And we can either continue with the same system, or you can take a bit of a hit and start again with a new system and a reset. But if you don't, you know, if you don't have a debt jubilee, you don't get to do the reset. You don't get to do the restart. And, you know, the history of back in the sort of old Jewish times was a history of debt jubilees. And the point of them was to every 50 years, let the guy off who's had a bad time. And people say, well, we shouldn't do that. Why should we let people off debt? They have a moral duty. But I say, I think the guy who lent them the money also has a moral duty to make sure that they can afford to pay it back before they lend it to them. But the way our banking system and credit mechanisms work today is it's a scoring system. It's an algorithm. There's no relationship as there used to be. And I realize maybe that's not practical. But what it means is, you know, we know that the banks in many ways are, you know, behave somewhat immorally at times by pushing credit onto those who really probably shouldn't have it. So there is an argument. It's a question of finding your point of where you cut off the debt cancellation, how far you go. And I don't know the answer to that. I just know that there's a clear point where it's on central bank balance sheet. That's easy, in a sense. And then there's definitely an argument for a push further and a reset and so on.
You know, I wrote, when I was still with the Boston Consulting Group many years back in 2011, I wrote a paper called Back to Mesopotamia, which was actually discussing a debt jubilee in a bit different way in doing it in a more structured way of having a wealth tax funding it, because it's, then you have organized the losses. But Still, before we come to the new monetary order, one last question on this debt restructuring, because if you do this, asset prices will fall significantly. So one point is, you know, canceling the debt, but of course, if you don't cancel all of it, it might well be that asset prices fall so much that many people will have negative equity. Should they then move out of their houses, or how would you resolve these issues?
Well, if you cancel a lot of their debt, you know, I'm not sure the house prices will fall that much, will they? I mean, I think that's up for debate, because
no. But if you change, sorry for interrupting, but if you change the system currently, if you buy a flat in London, you know, you pay a very high price. Why? Because you're competing with people who are able to get a big credit from the bank. But once the reset has started, or that is done, we will have a different system, and we will come to it, how it might look like. And then there's less credit available, and therefore this implies much lower asset prices compared to today.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I suppose if you've cancelled the debt proportionately across the system, or proportionally towards those with less equity, or, I mean, you'd have to think about that, I think, in terms of the workout. But yeah, I would accept the point that the reason asset prices and house prices are so high is because there's creation of so much debt. I don't know how much they go down when you cancel the debt. I think that's an interesting question, because it depends on how much stress there is in the system, probably. How much they go up after that is going to be much more muted because there's much less debt creation. Fair point. But how much do they go down, I think, probably depends on how much stress you create when you create the new order. I don't know the answer. I'd have to think that one through. And clearly it's a challenge. But the reality is, for the vast majority of homeowners, they have so much housing equity, a 10, 15% hit would not be too much of a big deal. And to flip it on its head, there's an awful lot of people who'd be quite happy because their housing's suddenly much more affordable and they haven't got one. And as you know, that's one of the great generational divides of the day. So you're creating more equality and a system that's fairer in the medium term. There's some challenges along the way. But there are winners and losers in every system. And if we don't change the system, the guys that haven't got a house today are going to be left even further behind. So generation rent, all that sort of stuff.
Well, let's assume the G20 gets together and says, okay, we understand this. We have to do a big global debt jubilee, orderly debt restructuring, and we have to change the system. So what would be your proposal for the new world order?
Well, I think one thing you definitely need is you need an anchor. So we need an anchor that stops commercial banks from creating liquidity in excessive amounts of debt. I think that's your first starter for 10. How you would do that, plausibly with a digital currency. What troubles me about that is, and this is a bit like Milton Friedman's rule, isn't it, that you basically should have 5% per annum growth in the money supply. It's another way of making that kind of rule so that debt creation and money creation don't become too rapid and don't create the boom and bust. That's certainly one thing you could do. And I think with that, you might want to introduce some sort of rule that during a financial crisis, that the amount of money that can be created in 1 year is relaxed for 12 months or 18 months. Because, of course, you know, this is where the problems have come in the past, isn't it? You have this, central banks have been, you know, historically been good at managing financial crises and providing liquidity, but they're struggling to know when to stop now. I think that's the problem, isn't it? You have QE1 as an emergency, but that emergency never seems to go away. It just keeps coming back. So I think maybe a digital currency with a fixed money supply growth each year, and that rule that allows you to deal with crises. I think a more radical option is one of the ones Positive Money put forward, which is the idea that you stop commercial banks from creating money, and they simply become what banks were originally, depositories. So you put your money in and the bank passes it on and clips the ticket along the way. So the bank doesn't create any new money. Commercial banks don't create new money. All money is created by the government. So sovereign money system. And, you know, the government has a rule. And actually, I like the idea. There's an oversight board, like we have an independent central bank. You're probably familiar with this proposal. Yeah, and they oversee, and the rule is 5% growth a year or a degree of flexibility or some sort of target that within a range, that kind of idea. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And then what you don't do is you don't have commercial banks creating a ton of money, a ton of debt that forces up asset prices and house prices and creates the income and wealth inequality. And then the other one, I suppose, is I think, you know, Lawrence Kotlikoff's proposals around, which I think you would describe as a, you know, and I'm not an absolute expert on this stuff, but it's sort of an advancement of the narrow banking proposal from the 1930s and with the idea that banks are quite narrow, quite clean in their function.
Lawrence Jacob Kotlikoff is an economics professor at Boston University. His proposed reform of the financial system called limited purpose banking transforms all financial companies with limited liability, including incorporated banks, insurance companies, financial exchanges and hedge funds, into pass-through mutual funds, which do not borrow to invest in risky assets, but instead allows the public to directly choose what risk it wishes to bear by purchasing more or less risky mutual funds. According to Kotlikoff, limited purpose banking keeps banks, insurance companies, hedge funds and other financial corporations from borrowing short and lending long, which leaves the public to pick up the pieces when things go south. Instead, Kotlikoff argues limited purpose banking forces financial intermediaries to limit their activities to their sole legitimate purpose, financial intermediation. It would substitute the vast array of federal and state financial regulatory bodies with a single financial regulator, which would have a narrow purpose, namely to verify, disclose and oversee the independent rating and custody of all securities purchased and sold by mutual funds.
And then you have investment trusts, which are, say exactly what they do on the tin. So if you lend money to an investment trust, it could be a mortgage investment trust. You take a bit more risk, and then the other side of that, you know, it's all mortgage lending, and you know, once in a while you might take a hit, but you're not going to be backed up by the government and the central bank. They're not going to bail you out. They're only bailing out the very pure narrow banking system where pure, simple savings with little return and therefore little risk are housed. So you're splitting the financial system into very narrow backed, government backed system, and then a broader, riskier sort of almost wild west, if you like, of finance, that you put your money there, you take your choice, off you go. So I don't know the answer. The one thing I know we must have is we must have an anchor, and we must stop the debt creation and the liquidity creation, because I think that will go an awful long way to addressing, you know, a lot of the unfairness in the world economy today.
On your point of positive money, I'm sure you're familiar with the Chicago Plan. The Chicago Plan in the 30s, which was similar. And actually, the IMF, they did a study a few years back doing a calculation, and they really found that it would work. And actually, in the shift from the current system to the positive money system, actually it would generate so much money that it was also allowed to reduce debt levels. So this would also be a way of doing a reset, at least according to the IMF. Chris, you're advising financial investors, that's what I read on the webpage of your company. How do they react to your thinking? You know, because I could imagine that not so many were so happy about your views in the article and say, well, you know, but we like the system as it is. Why, you know, and you benefit from it as well. So why do you want to change it? What do you hear from your clients, if I may ask?
They're much sort of kinder hearted than you think. I think they all look at the system and think it's sort of nuts. I mean, that was one of the other points I made in the article. I mean, we sit here in financial markets and the key to working out where the S&P is going to go is just working out what the Fed's going to get up to and how much money they're going to print and create. It's kind of lost, you know, financial markets are supposed to be about fundamentals and price discovery. They're not supposed to be about central bank liquidity. You know, the fact that the Bank of Japan and the Swiss National Bank between them have created about roughly, I think it's $400-500 billion of new money and bought equities with it, just tells you the system's completely wrong. And all, you know, the clients I talk to, it varies a bit depending on where you are in the world, but certainly, you know, I think it's Switzerland where, you know, and Germany, the home of sound money, I always think, you know, people just look at this system and they're aghast, you know, not surprisingly. I mean, the fact that the Swiss National Bank a few years ago was one of the biggest holders of Apple, it just says it all. I mean, it's clearly not the way it's supposed to be. So actually, surprisingly, I think lots of people in financial markets think the system should change. I really do think that.
And I have to tell you, as a German, I prefer having Apple stocks than having Target 2 receivables in the Eurozone. So probably it's not so stupid from the Swiss to buy a real asset in such a world, because if there will be a reset, I'd rather have at the end an Apple stock. Also, it might have much lower price than having probably a currency or being whatever taxed away. So, but, you know, the big assumption you're raising in your article and also in our conversation was, okay, the G20 has to sit together and come to a solution. And my skepticism comes from the fact that, at least if I look at German politics, I doubt that German politicians are able to understand the problem and that they are really think that's what's the right way to do, because Germans anyhow think completely differently. And having the central bank cancel that, I think it's totally no-no. So let's take a more realistic view of saying, what happens if the G20 or the politicians don't come to the conclusion to follow our advice? And I would say, because I share your view, what is then the scenario? What will come next?
Well, I think the system continues as it is today. I think there are probably two likely outcomes. One is, an ultimate collapse of trust in the dollar at some stage because they've engaged too much in what's basically MMT today, as in money creation to fund government spending and so on. So that's one path we may be traveling down. And if you look at the history of reserve currencies, you know, when they sort of engage, there's about six or seven things that Charles Kindleberger talks about and Kennedy talk about in their books that tell you that they're coming to the end of their life cycle. And, you know, one of those is printing money to currency debasement, basically. The loss of the manufacturing base and the rise of another global exporter and all these sort of things, and political discord internally, all these sort of things are preconditions. So that's one path, I think, that the reserve currency, the dollar, a bit like the pound, maybe more dramatically, perhaps not. That's one thing that will cause a lot of disruption, I think, in global financial markets. And sort of a variation on that theme is we might well be building towards a stock market bubble. And I don't mean just in growth stocks and tech stocks in the States, but a global stock market bubble and a global housing market bubble in over the next course of 3, 4, 5 years. And that could create quite a downdraft if that starts unwinding at the same time, which is perfectly plausible. And actually, I'm a big believer in these 18-year land cycles, which would suggest we're sort of 14 years into this one from its last peak in 2006, which would suggest another 4 years of good house price growth in the US, UK and other parts of the world, and a peak in sort of 2024, 25, maybe 2026. And if the Fed remains on board and creates a lot of money until then, not only are tech stocks going to still be expensive, but I think value and cyclicals will also be expensive then as well. So you could get this combination whereby we've inflated all asset classes, and then maybe inflation turns up, or maybe the central bank over tightens for whatever reason. So you could have a bursting of those bubbles. So I think that's one possible route. And then I think the other way this plays out is probably to do with the politics. And, you know, we've seen it in the last 10 years, haven't we? The rise of, nationalist politics, Le Pen, and, you know, the Brexit, some of Brexit was that, I acknowledge that, in Italy, of course, Salvini and all these sort of guys, and not Salvini, is it Salvini? I forget who I'm, Five Star Degree, all those guys. And, you know, there's several examples across Europe and Trump and so on. So the nationalistic politics has been accelerated, I think, by this vaccine and the pandemic, and that could come to a head, and we could see more. You could see more Brexit, more countries in the Eurozone leaving the Euro or whatever it might be. They can cause all sorts of problems or bad policy choices because you've got populist politicians in power.
Yeah, because good that you came in the end to the Euro, because I would have said, well, most of my listeners would say, he's worried about the dollar, but why isn't he worried about the Euro? So for the Euro, you also see, okay, they don't embark yet on a full-blown MMT because it's a fact that it's Germans might not like it. But, you know, the Eurozone also is not on a stable footing.
No, that's right. I think the debt mutualization kind of helps a little bit, but really there's lots of challenges out there that really I think are going to cause lots of friction going forward.
So one last question I've got probably concerning the climate change policies, because some people would argue, well, we have now a new world with governments being funded by the central bank, so about MMT, and we have a good purpose. We have the purpose of fighting climate change, so we spend a lot of money. That's a big difference between the policies today and to the policies post the great financial crisis. Therefore, this is going to be a game changer leading to higher growth, higher productivity, higher inflation, and therefore allows us to bring down debt levels relative to GDP.
Maybe. I mean, I think the principle is really, you know, you can't print your way to prosperity. And you can make the argument that you can print money and spend it on infrastructure or stuff that raises your trend growth rate. But I'm not convinced you're going to do that with climate change. What we're trying to do is stop a problem from happening, and maybe you help growth a bit, but I'm not sure that's actually correct, is it? What are we doing? We're destroying current capital and replacing it with new. Take the car fleet. You know, maybe there's a few more years left in your car, but the governments are telling you you've got to destroy it and buy another one. That's not going to raise productivity levels. That's just replacing old capital stock with new because of regulation. So, you know, I'm not convinced. And the same with wind farms and solar. They're very noble. You know, I understand the climate change argument, but I don't think printing money is going to solve it. You're just replacing, as I say, old electricity generating capacity with new. So, I mean, some of it's bullish. You've got to argue that if electricity becomes very, very cheap and constant, then sure, that's helpful. Energy prices can go down. But at the moment, it's not cheaper energy, is it? It's subsidized energy.
Yes, especially from the German perspective, I can tell you it's very expensive for energy. So, Chris, so my summary or my takeaway from our conversation would be the current system encourages faster growing debt. This debt leads to instability and fragility of the system. It can't go on forever because it leads to asset bubbles. It leads to inequality. So we have either political unrest or we have more financial crisis. At some stage, they might be too big for the central banks to handle. And we have now two options. One option is we have wise politicians and central bankers who acknowledge the problem and proactively act. Or we continue to party for a few years' time, and then we will have a major problem. Is this an exaggerated summary of what you basically say? That's basically where how you see the world.
I think that's right. I just hope there's enough agitation from various groups and people and individuals that pushes politicians and central bankers to make better choices. But yeah, I'd say that's absolutely right. We need a reset, and we need an anchor. And it'll be really important for economic justice and fairness in the world, and therefore for stability of the global and political economy.
Chris, thank you very much for these insights. This was very helpful, and I'm sure, let's hope with our conversation we make a little contribution, because it's heard also from some politicians, as I know, that this is going to come, that we have a constructive way of dealing with the problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. I look forward to welcoming you again in the future for another edition of English Language Interviews of the podcast BTO Beyond the Obvious 2.0. I'm Daniel Stelter. Thank you very much for tuning in.
BTO Beyond the Obvious 2.0.